Welcome to episode one of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode is entitled 9/11, 15 Years Later, What Have We Learned? Today, the U.S. and its allies are entangled in wars both known and unknown throughout much of the world, including Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, and Pakistan. What have we learned in the years and wars since 9/11, and where do we go from here? This episode features a short introductory talk by Donna Marsh O'Connor, who lost her pregnant 28-year-old daughter, Vanessa, on 9/11. Donna is a national spokesperson for September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. The rest of the hour is a talk by ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Ray served as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from JFK to George H.W. Bush, and from 1981 to 1985 briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's five most senior national security advisors. Donna Marsh O'Connor and Ray McGovern spoke at Binghamton University on September 9th, 2016. And now, Donna Marsh O'Connor.
So a little bit about Peaceful Tomorrows. They are a group of family members who came together in the early days after 9/11 because they wanted to, I believe, recuperate their family members' names from the use of those names for war. And so the primary message of Peaceful Tomorrows is the greatest crime against me doesn't justify my perpetrating crimes against others. It is such a simple message, and yet it is probably the one that has been the most difficult in the post 9/11 days to drive home, and particularly for me, a person who was changed by the events of that day. And despite the fact that there's been this great cleansing of Lower Manhattan, for me, the most important view of Ground Zero was in the days just following, in the days when family members were protected from all of the PCBs that were in the air. And so I remember in the early days wanting desperately to find my kid. And, you know, as any mother knows, and when I dropped her off the first day at kindergarten, I knew I was going to have a hard time finding her when I picked her up at 3 o'clock. And sure enough, somehow she slipped right by me and went across the street to some boy's house. I would have ripped apart every apartment building in the Bronx to find her. And that was my instinct on 9/11, that the only place I wanted to be was in that dirt pile of fire and ash and steel. And for me, and I still sometimes can't believe that I think this, those gothic black beams that stood up from Ground Zero were to me the only comforting sight on earth, because she, I believed, was still there. And of course, we were prevented from going to the site for our own good. And I will never forget the first time we were driven there by very generous police officers who knew they need to see it. And we took a few turns, and I looked at office buildings that were sheared off, and, you know, it was like looking into a dollhouse. Mounds and mounds of earth, gray, black earth, with fire engines that looked like they were only 10 feet away, but they were this big. So the scale of this horror was something that, as a child, in my wildest nightmares, I never could have anticipated would actually happen to my own child. I am not away from that site. I have never been to the 9/11 Museum. I have not been to the beautiful fountains where people have taken pictures of her name with roses on them and sent them to me, and I appreciate that. But a cleansed view of what happened, I think it's too early for a cleansed view. It's stunning to me when I walk into a classroom to teach on the first day of the semester now that many of my students were 3 to 5 years old on the day of 9/11. And yet, like, they still have some sort of vestige of whatever a collective memory would be. And I really dread the day when they don't remember that. I have been to the Katrina Museum. We had one thing in common with Katrina victims that struck me as I was going to give a talk in 2005 on the anniversary, and that was that after Hurricane Katrina hit, many of the bodies of the people who drowned in their own attics, and that was really hard for me to sort of get my mind around, that, you know, my kid died in fire and steel, and the most crushingly for her beautiful buildings on earth. And there were people in our nation who drowned in their attics. And what struck me was listening to the reports of the bodies being held in a place where people could not go and identify their loved ones' remains. And Vanessa was lucky. She was pulled from the pile on September 24th. We were not notified until the first Monday in January. And I knew I was going to get the call that day. And I've written about this. And right now, my interest is more in what actually happened to my daughter in the last moments, but also in the last years of our life together. So I no longer really think of myself as a peace activist. I never really wanted to be an activist. I wanted to be a laziest. I love my kids. I loved playing with them and taking them to water. I loved lecturing them. I loved bossing them around. And I loved having a grown daughter who would cook for me. And in the days just following, I just could not believe what was being done in her name by our government all over the world. And I could not believe that everyone in this country did not see exactly what I was seeing. And then I remember one day driving home from New York. And in those days, like, I don't think I really walked. I think I floated. I don't know that my feet really touched the ground. I was driving home, and I had not been able to listen to music in a long time because I never knew what triggers would come on that would just, I'd lose it. And so I was listening to an NPR station, and I heard this, like, really amazing guy, and his name was Ray McGovern. And he was talking about the Bush administration. And everything that I had guessed, little stupid kid from the Bronx, was being articulated in this sound, calm, sober, grown-up way. And I was hearing that nowhere else. We had gone from, you know, CNN and our local news to MSNBC, Fox News, where we can select our flavor of news of the day, to 24/7 broadcasts about what happened on 9/11. Our television screens were filled with images. In boxes next to the television screens were the graphics we were to read, and the scroll underneath was all of that important data, and it changed forever how we consumed news. News became not only entertainment, it became our right to have it delivered in the flavor of the day that we chose. And here was this man who was saying things that I think everyone in America needs to hear. Today, Ray asked if he showed a video if I would find it disturbing. I find everything disturbing nowadays. There is a part of me that I will say, I want my daughter back. I want my country back. And so it's better for me as a parent, as a citizen of this nation, as a person who once considered herself the stupidest patriot on earth. I couldn't listen to America songs without sobbing, to a point now where I just want to stop using the word freedom and liberty without actually demanding that I have some. So I would really like to turn the floor over to Ray McGovern, because I think he is the person we all need to hear. And I really want to thank you in public for being you and for carrying on and telling the truth about everything. So thank you.
So it's fallen to me to talk about what happened after 9/11. And it's no fun to say these things because, as Donna said, one likes to be proud of our country and our leadership. But you've heard the expression quite often, and you can actually repeat it after me or complete the sentence for me. That would be even better. After 9/11, everything changed, right? Okay. So, before 9/11, we didn't like Iraq much. We had actually imposed hard sanctions on Iraq, killing 500,000, like 500,000 children under the age of 5. The Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, when she was asked about that, whether she thought that was worth it, she said, yeah, we think it's worth it. So there had been a long history of enmity between our two countries, but we didn't really consider them a threat to the United States. I mean, after all, look at the map or look at the globe, you know. And did they have weapons of mass destruction? Well, that would be a stretch, because the UN thought all those weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed after the first Gulf War. So what happened was this. Just a brief word about before 9/11. In late February of 2001, Colin Powell got up and he said, Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. He's not a threat to anybody. Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. February 22nd, 2001. July 30th, 2001, Condoleezza Rice said a Sunday talk show said, Saddam Hussein is not a threat even to his immediate neighbors. We have been able to keep his weapons from him. Now, that was July 30th. So fast forward through August and the first 11 days of September 2001. My math is right, that's about 6 weeks. So here we had a situation where literally everything changed, because what we are being asked to believe was that 6 months before 9/11, Saddam Hussein not only had no weapons of mass destruction, was not even a threat to his own neighbors, and all of a sudden, after 9/11, weapons of mass destruction descended like manna from heaven for a soft landing on the sands of Iraq, where God made that terrible decision to put our oil. You can't get weapons of mass destruction in 6 weeks or 6 months. Takes 6 years, maybe. So, you know, you didn't have to be an intelligence analyst to figure out there's something wrong here, to smell a rat. And sure enough, the rat really smelled. What happened, of course, was that the Episcopal Diocese of Washington was persuaded to let George Bush speak from the National Cathedral, and he said, in effect, "Vengeance is mine, say I, George W. Bush. Everybody's going to feel what we have to dish out." He said that several times. In other words, instead of appealing to the best instincts of Americans, he appealed to the worst ones. And then we had Afghanistan. And then we had Colin Powell going before the United Nations. Now, he claims he was lied to by the intelligence. And that's true. But Colin Powell had been around for decades. You can tell when you're being lied to. He wanted to play the game. They thought that by attacking Iraq, it would be, one of them said, a cakewalk, you know, a piece of cake that come in, would be welcomed by the Iraqis with bread and salt, and everything would be hunky-dory. As you all know, that's not the case. And let me tell you about the weapons of mass destruction. I know from my service of 27 years in the CIA as an analyst what kind of capabilities we had from our overhead, we call it national technical means, but what it is satellites, imaging, not only with photography, but infrared and radar and everything you can imagine. And we were blanketing. We were blanketing, you know, that part of the world. Now, the fellow in charge of the National Intelligence and Mapping place, the imagery analysis, in other words, that was a fellow named James Clapper, 3-star general at the time. And he saw to it that when these emigres came to the Pentagon and said, oh, there's a big chemical factory there at these coordinates, and his analysts found out that that was a chicken farm, James Clapper made sure that that never got reported up to anybody, okay? Now, anybody know what position James Clapper has now under Obama? Pardon? Yeah, he's the imperial wizard of the intelligence community. He's the director of national intelligence. Now, did he do anything untoward more recently? Well, he was the guy that 2 years ago was asked by the senator from Washington, Ron Wyden, does NSA monitor the conversations of millions of Americans? No. Not wittingly. Bald-faced lie, under oath, okay? Now, you would think he would have been cashiered or maybe, you know, given a job in the filing booth or something, but no, he's the premier director of national intelligence. What does that tell you about our president? Does that suggest to you that our president is afraid of the CIA and the associated agencies? I think he is. In any case, Clapper kept his mouth shut, even though there was no photography to prove there were weapons of mass destruction. And there's a fellow who lives not far from Albany anyway. His name is Scott Ritter. Anyone heard of Scott Ritter? He was the chief UN inspector, okay, for Iraq. And he was that during the time in 1991, after the Gulf War, they came in and they swept through that country and determined and verified that all those weapons had been destroyed. Now, in 1995, so 4 years later, two of Saddam Hussein's sons-in-law defected. They came into Jordan. And they were immediately debriefed by CIA, by the British, by the UN, and the debriefer said, okay, now, his name was Kamel, Hussein Kamel. Hussein, tell us about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And he said, I'm sorry? Tell us about the weapons. There aren't any. Well, what do you mean there aren't any? Well, I thought you knew. that they were all destroyed before the UN inspectors could even come in after the first Gulf War in 1991. Are you sure? He said, well, perhaps you haven't done your homework, but I was in charge. I was in charge of the nuclear, biological, chemical, and rocket program in Iraq, and I ordered them destroyed before the UN inspectors could find them all. You did? Well, how do you know they were destroyed? Well, Hussein Kamel was getting a little impatient. He said, well, I don't know how it works in your country, but when I'm in charge of a program and I order these things destroyed, they get destroyed. Yeah, but how do you know? Did you inspect? Oh, yeah, spot check these places. Yeah, what are you trying to get me to say? That there's still weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? There aren't any. He was totally mystified by this attitude. 1995, the UN prepared a detailed debriefing report on what Hussein Kamel said. Now, as the war fever got stoked up by the Bush administration in 2002 and the beginning of 2003, remember the attack on Iraq in March of 2003, what happened was someone thought that this was crazy, and they thought, well, maybe if we got a hold of that UN report and leaked it to Newsweek, maybe we could stop this war. And so that someone did do that. And Newsweek, and this is the end of January 2003, Newsweek looked at that and said, whoa, really, yuck, whoa, that's not what we've been saying. But to their credit, they put it in their Periscope part, that little part in the front of Newsweek, little report, which appeared in the printed version on the 3rd of March. So 19 March is when we attacked, minus 3, I think that's what, 2 weeks plus before the attack. Now, the mainstream media had been rooting all along for an attack. And so they were quite nonplussed, and they didn't know what to do. And so how do you do that if you're a mainstream stenographer? I mean, that's what they were, stenographers rather than journalists. What do you do? Well, you check it out. So what did they do? They went to the CIA, public affairs people, and they said, what is this about a debriefing report saying there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? And the PR fellow said, well, that is absurd, it's wrong, it's unfounded, and it's false. All the words that he could think of that say the same thing. And what did our journalists do? Anybody know? They said, oh, wow, thanks for telling us, because we were going to write a story about that. That would be quite a story, because now we've been saying, wow, that's how bad it was, folks. Now, who was that person? I can tell you now, that person was Scott Ritter. He felt strongly enough, given all his work in verifying Iraqi compliance with the destruction of weapons of mass destruction, that he leaked the UN report to Newsweek. Now, the UN report has no classification system, so in a way, he wasn't leaking classified information, but that's what he did. And that's what they didn't do. That's how corrupt the system was. So the other thing I'll say about this is that Scott, who lives, as I say, not far from here, I tried to see his senator. His senator was a woman, Hillary Clinton, I think was her name, yeah. And he did everything he could to see her and to tell her, look, Senator Clinton, there aren't any weapons of mass. I can tell you that. I can show you the drawings. I can show you the debriefing. Please, And guess what she said? Don't let him in. Don't let him in. Scott Ritter couldn't get past the front door of Hillary Clinton's office in New York or in Washington. She didn't want to hear it. So if you hear Hillary Clinton or George Bush or anybody else say this was a terrible mistake, it wasn't a mistake. It was fraud on the part of Bush, and it was the most despicable kind of political maneuvering on the part of Hillary Clinton, because she wanted to become president someday, and she thought if she didn't show how tough she was here, then, you know, she might not get the nomination. Now she's got the nomination, and we'll have to see what happens. That was the story on the weapons of mass destruction. Now, on the links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, that was of equal interest. Why? Because the Bush and Cheney regime wanted very much to associate Saddam Hussein with, what are we discussing tonight? 9/11, okay? And before the attack on Iraq, 69% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein played some kind of role in 9/11. It was a masterful propaganda coup. Now, did the intelligence community support that? No way did we. And that's why I asked Rumsfeld on the 6th of May, 10 years ago, why did you say the evidence was bulletproof that Saddam Hussein had these ties, operational ties with al-Qaeda, when other people were saying there was no evidence? All my colleagues were saying there was no evidence. Well, that was the reason he said that, because he wanted to use this again to justify the war.
You're listening to a talk by Donna Marsh O'Connor and Ray McGovern entitled 9/11, 15 Years Later, What Have We Learned? They spoke at Binghamton University on September 9th, 2016. This is episode 1 of the Other Voices, Other Choices series. You can find a video of the entire talk at othervoicesotherchoices.com and at the YouTube channel of the same name.
So what else should I say here about 9/11? Well, nobody asked the question as to why. Why would these hijackers and the people who planned all of this for them, why would they do such a thing? And once we figure out that, well, maybe we can figure out how to defeat terrorism, okay? Now, if you ask people why these things were hijacked, I dare say most people right here tonight would say, well, you know, maybe they would say, because they hate us. Or they hate our freedom, or they hate our, well, hello, I don't know if they hate, I mean, everybody I think would like to be free, so why is it? And why do they hate us if that's what they hate? Now, I have a simple solution as to how to defeat terrorism. It's the same way that you defeat malaria. Yeah, it's that simple. With malaria, you find the mosquitoes, right? And you trace them back to where they breed in the swamp, okay? And you get that swamp, and then you line up three platoons of sharpshooters, and you try to get each one of those mosquitoes as they leave the swamp, right? Not right. What do you do? Anybody? Yeah, drain the swamp. Now, there's a swamp of grievances that the people who hate us, legitimate grievances that won't quit, the way we've propped up their dictators that oppress them, the way our policy is so joined with Israelis' policy that there's no, as they like to say in Washington, there's no space or air between our two policies. Now, how do the people who are oppressed, the Palestinians, for example, whose territories have been occupied since 1967, how do they feel about America giving the kind of support to Israel without which they could not do this anymore? If you look at the 9/11 Commission report, and the first thing I did was to look for what they might have gotten from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Anybody remember who he was? The sort of the brains behind the attack. You know, he sort of planned it, and so he was one of the guys that they captured. And when the 9/11 Commission people were drafting their report, they found out, same way I did, reading the New York Times, hey, they got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They call him KSM. Okay, KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Well, I know these young people, two of them at least, that worked on this commission. I know what we'll do. Let's ask them why he did it. Part of our portfolio here is to ask them why they did it. So let's ask them. George Tenet, the head of the CIA, says, no way, no way are we going to give you access to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any of the other major terrorists that we've captured. Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene, the heads of the 9/11 Commission, say in their book, it was just really clear that Tenet was really going to just insist on that, and so Lee Hamilton knows Tenet for 25 years. He's not going to back off on that. You know, like the 9/11 Commission couldn't subpoena that or get to. Well, anyhow, long story short, they sent questions to the CIA. Please ask, in a word, please ask the brainstorm here, the brains behind the strike, why he did it. Anybody know what he said? Well, suffice it to say that it wasn't given much prominence in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. What he said was this, and you can look at the report. It's page 147. Now, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had studied at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He has an engineering degree from Greensboro, from North Carolina. Mechanical engineering. And so these young people working on the 9/11 Commission report say, aha, that must be it. Somebody must have cursed at him, somebody called him a towel head, or somebody demeaned him, or maybe had an affair of the heart that went sour. That's why he hated it. That's why he attacked us, right? Well, that turned out not to be the case. What Khalid Sheikh Mohammed says, and what is recorded on page 147 of the book, is of the study, the 9/11 Commission report, is this. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's animus toward the United States sprang not from any experience he had while as a student in this country, but rather from his intense hatred for U.S. policy singularly favoring the state of Israel, period, end quote. Am I suggesting that that was the only reason? No, I'm not. I'm suggesting that was a major reason, and I'm suggesting that's not a reason you're going to see in any media in this country. And there are lots of reasons for that. We can explore those later. So what about the 9/11 Commission report? Let me finish up talking about that just a little. It's a cover-up. Pure and simple. It's a cover-up. I could tell as soon as I read it. The question is, what's being covered up? Okay? Now, you don't have to believe me about the cover-up. 2 years after their report, the 9/11 Commission report, Lee Hamilton, the Democrat that they tried out for such occasions, and Governor Tom Keene of New Jersey wrote a book. And in the book, they said, quote, we were set up to fail. We were not given enough money. We were not given enough time. We were not given enough access to sensitive information. We were set up to fail, period, end quote. Now, isn't that nice that they tell us 2 years after they issue this very fancy, very well-edited report claiming that they had investigated 9/11? It's a sham. And what's needed, of course, is an independent investigation. And my friends in New York, New York City in that area, and my cousins in New Jersey, my wife lost a cousin at the top of one of the towers, feel really strongly that we're due. And of course, the widows and the families of 9/11 people are due an honest, thorough investigation, no holds barred. And we have to force that to happen, because it's not going to happen unless we force it to happen. Now, people say to me, now, Ray, what do you think about these conspiracy theorists? And I say, I think they're terrific. And I resent you calling them conspiracy theorists. All they're trying to do is find out what Kane and Hamilton didn't find out. They're looking for the truth, and this is important, because after 9/11, everything changed. So I feel really strongly against people who criticize people who are trying to figure out what happened. People also say to me, now, Ray, for God's sake, you know Cheney. You've written extensively about him as you watched him do the kinds of things he did. Don't you believe that he's capable of orchestrating something like 9/11? And I say, sure, I believe that. Well, they said, well, then, I said, but, you know, I don't do faith-based intelligence. It doesn't matter what I believe. It's what I see in terms of the empirical evidence. Now, the cover-up. Again, what's being covered up? Well, if you reduce it to its simplest terms, it's either gross misfeasance or gross malfeasance. Let's take misfeasance first. Colleen Rowley, the FBI lawyer who was very active in pursuing what happened at 9/11 and criticizing the FBI for whom she worked, she says, Ray, remember, you worked in government. You know as well as I do that people outside government have no idea of the immense capacity for the various agencies to screw up royally all at the same time, to miss big things, to really screw up. So when you're looking at this, don't dismiss that possibility, because it's certainly as likely as not. We know there was no sharing between the CIA and the FBI. We know all kinds of things that didn't happen, okay? We know some of whys, but so that's one possibility. That's the misfeasance, okay? That's the stupidity, that's gross negligence that could be called criminal negligence in my book. The other possibility is something much more sinister. That would be malfeasance. That would be people that actively let it happen or actually plan to let it happen. That's another possibility, and that's what my friends in New York and elsewhere are looking into. We don't have any answers to that. And what we've been looking for mostly is, hey, it's been 15 years, right? 15 years. Usually, within 15 years, somebody gets drunk at some bar and says, you know, oh, hey, oh, Lisa, I'll tell you, look, let me tell you how we wired those buildings, and I'll tell you how those things went. That hasn't happened, okay? Or you have somebody who was involved and has a qualm of conscience and says, you know, before I die, I think I have to make a clean breath of this and just say, you know, what really happened. That hasn't happened yet. That's far from solid proof of anything, but you would look for that to happen. So where am I? I'm at a point where I say, look, we have more information on the Saudi angle now. We might be able to force more information out of the stuff that's been redacted. We have to keep plugging, and my friends in New York are keeping plugging. So what do? Well, we do the things that Donna has so articulately expressed, and that is we don't return violence for violence. And those of us who know the expression, an eye for an eye, know that you pursue that and the whole world goes blind. Okay, I was very active with The World Can't Wait, and also Not in My Name in the first 2 months after 9/11. But we also have to we have to do this before our country goes even farther down the slippery scale. There is, Dr. King once said, there is such a thing as too late. Let me share a story out of my experience in Germany about too late. Some of you know Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was the Lutheran pastor who stood up to the Nazis. they caught up with him, and they captured him, and he was put in a Berlin prison, and they hanged him just as the Allies were coming up to free the concentration camps and so forth. There was another fellow who taught at the University of Berlin. His name was Haushofer. Has anyone heard of Haushofer? No. Okay. Well, his name was Albrecht Haushofer, and he was a geolog. He was a geology professor, and he got tenure, and some of you know what tenure means, right? Okay. And he got tenure because he kept his mouth shut, because he didn't speak out like so many in church and state everywhere else. But he had a conscience, and so he started feeling really, really conscience-stricken when his Jewish friends and Gypsy friends and other people were being carted off to concentration camps. So he spoke out against Hitler, and he acquired quite an amazing following at the university, so they wrapped him up and threw him in a different prison in Berlin, just as the Allies were approaching. Now, they either hanged you or they shot you, the Gestapo did, if you were convicted of such crimes as, you know, the kind of thing that Haushofer and Bonhoeffer were doing. So in this particular prison, they shot you. But before they shoot you or hang you, you had to sign a confession, of course. I mean, the Germans are very orderly. If they don't have a confession from you, then it's not quite tidy enough, okay? So they said, okay, here, Albrecht, sign this. We're going to shoot you tomorrow, so sign this tonight. And he said, forget about it. I'm not going to sign any confession. Well, they got so angry that they shot him anyway. But as they picked him up from the floor, out from his pocket came this zettel, a little piece of paper, and on it was written his confession in the form of a sonnet. It's short. I'd like to read it to you, and then I'll translate it as we go along. But it's very moving because it speaks to the issue of there is such a thing as too late. Schuld. Anybody here have German? Okay, well, you can check mine. Here, okay, Schuld is guilt. Okay, so this is his sonnet confession, Schuld. Okay, doch. Bin ich schuldig, aber anders als ihr denkt. Yeah, I'm guilty, but it's not what you're thinking. Ich musste früher meine Pflicht erkennen. Ich musste schärfer Unheil, Unheil nennen. I should have spoken out much earlier. I should have more sharply called evil, evil. Mein Urteil habe ich zu lang gelenkt. I put off my judgment far too long. Ich habe gewarnt. I did warn, and he did warn. And, you know, he had his following there. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug. What's genug? Enough, right. Ich habe gewarnt, aber nicht genug und klar. What's klar? Claro, klar, clear, cool. There's no comparative in German. Klar is klar, right? Ich habe gewarnt, I did warn, aber nicht genug und klar. Und heute weiß ich, was ich schuldig war. And today, I know what I was guilty of. Whoa. So is he confessing to dissonance or opposing the Nazis? Well, he's confessing to not having spoken out early enough, sharply enough, clear, claro, clearly enough. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that it's up to us citizens here to keep up with what's going on, and then to find our voice. What happened in Germany in the 30s with people couldn't find their voice, the religions, the churches, the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church could not find their voice. The people like Bonhoeffer were the exception. So if our institutions, even our religious institutions, which have some claim or used to have some claim to moral authority, if they won't speak out, who's got to speak out? Who's got to divulge what's going on here? One of my favorite theologians is Annie Dillard. And she says, you know, Who shall ascend to the altar of God? Who shall stand in God's holy place? There is only us. There never has been any other. So folks, there is only us. There never has been any other. And let's choose this 15th anniversary to make a new commitment to find out what's going on. Now, this is probably the most important thing I'll say tonight. I've been around 53 years in Washington since I left my native Bronx. So I've seen a lot of change. But there's one change that dwarfs all the other changes in significance, and that is that we no longer have a free media. That is big. In my day, when I was most of your age, I could read the New York Times and find out what was going on. Now I read the New York Times and I find out what's missing. I find out what they're skewing or what they're completely avoiding, okay? So the Fourth Estate is dead. Fourth Estate. Yeah, that comes back, that comes from the English politician, Edmund Burke. It's worth recounting why Fourth Estate. See, in those days, there were three estates in Parliament. There were two commons and one lords, okay? So he gets up, he's a member of Parliament, and he says, now, I'm delighted to be a member of one of these three estates here, but there's a fourth estate, and that estate is much more important, much more important than all of us put together. And that is the fourth estate, and those are the gentlemen up there in the balcony, gentlemen of the press, who keep us honest. They are far more important than all of us in Parliament. Whoa, that's the fourth estate. Was he right? Jefferson said the same thing a little bit later. He said, somebody said, well, if you had a choice just between a government and a free press, which would you choose? He says, that's a no-brainer, a free press every time. Otherwise, you get a dictatorial government. So we've got to keep that in mind and make sure that we know where to get information. Now, my favorite place for information, and I have to confess that I learned just as much about American history, current and past, as I did in all my years at Fordham University, that's Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Now, some of the younger folks haven't heard of Amy Goodman, but if you just go to democracynow.org, you'll find her. Now, in retirement, you know, I'm entitled to sleep in, right? My wife says, when are you going to retire? But my pastor says, retirement is a secular concept. Anyhow, I get up at 17 minutes before 8 every morning, Monday through Friday. Why? Well, because it takes 15 minutes for an Irishman to brew a decent cup of coffee. And I'm talking instant coffee here, you know. And then 2 minutes to drink enough so that I'm awake enough to watch Amy Goodman. Now, I learned later, after about 2 years, McGovern, you don't have to get up that early. You can watch Amy Goodman at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. If you wait till 12 o'clock, you can just read it. It's much faster, right? You know? But I do that. Number one, it gets me up. Number two, it usually informs me before anybody else what's going on. And when I get a call from RT or Al Jazeera, CNN won't touch me anymore, then I know, you know, so, oh yeah, sure, I know about that. Yeah, sure, I'd be happy to come in and do a little interview. So what I'm saying is here, democracynow.org, you can look at it late at night. You can look at it anytime, and you can read it or you can watch it. How many people know about the insurrection in North Dakota, where Native Americans have been bitten by dogs in the manner of Bull Connor? Well, Amy Goodman was there. She was there last Friday. She was there last Saturday. She's there today, I think. It has to do with an oil pipeline they want to put under their sacred ground and under their river, and the danger that they'll lose their clean water. So there's that. Now, how many of you folks know what today is? It's an anniversary, and I'll give you a hint. It's the 45th anniversary. Yeah. Right. Could you say that louder?
The Attica Prison Uprising.
Right. Where's Attica? Not far from here, right? Okay. And what happened that day?
Massacre.
Massacre of whom?
Prisoners, mostly,
and some of the guards, right. And why? Because they sent the troops in. Because they sent the National Guard in. Were there legitimate grievances? Was there a swamp of grievances there on the part of the inmates? There sure as hell were. And how do we choose to deal with that? Send in the sharpshooters. So the reason I know that is because Amy Goodman had it on a program this morning. Everyone who lives around here should know what happened in Attica, particularly since our prison complex is so great and such a blight on our civilization. Dostoevsky, my favorite novelist, said, if you want to measure the level of civilization in a country, go visit the prisons. Last thing I'll do here, and I promise this is the very last thing. We Irish people like to talk forever. I have a poem here that I copied off the wall of a Catholic worker down in the Bowery. She was letting me use her room since she was in Iraq or Syria, I forget which one, attending to people that she had befriended 10 years ago. The author of the poem is a fellow named Daniel Berrigan, who died just several months ago, and who was a prophet, who was a real leader in my view. And he didn't publish this poem, he just gave it to some special people, like the person whose room I was using. And so I said, wow, I think I'm gonna copy this poem and memorize it and, you know, kind of use it. And I haven't memorized it yet, but I would like to read it to you because it speaks to what many of us are involved in or want to be involved in, and it gives me courage. Now let's see, maybe I'll get my glasses here. The title of this poem is Some, S-O-M-E. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for having been taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth, they walked the waters, they walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said. And because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat and the children born and the risen bread. I recommend that all of us take to heart this anniversary and kind of pledge to ourselves that we'll become some of these some and do what we can to bring justice back to our land so that we can be proud again being Americans. Thank you very much for listening. I understand there'll be questions.
Now, one of the things that you didn't happen to mention, and I'm wondering how much influence it might have had on the going into the war in 03, the name of Halliburton.
Well, Halliburton's where Cheney used to work, and the stock went up in Halliburton real, real high and real, real fast as soon as they got all the contracts to provide things that we Army people used to provide ourselves in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now where else, you know. So yeah, there was, you know, what the Pope talks about, I don't often quote the Pope, but when he got up before Congress in September of last year, what he said was, you know, the real problem is the blood-soaked arms traders. Whoa, doesn't sound like a Pope, does it? The blood-soaked arms traders, okay? So what he's talking about is what Eisenhower warned us about, the military-industrial congressional complex. Now, many of you don't know that Eisenhower intended to add congressional. It was going to be not only the military-industrial complex, it was going to be the military-industrial congressional complex, because he was there. He saw how it worked, okay? Now, when the Pope said, the real problem is the blood-drenched arms traders, all the senators, And then they felt, just to make sure that the last couple of thousand that was given to them by Lockheed or Boeing was still there in their back pocket, because that's how it works, folks. That's how it works. Good news is that today, Congress faced into this and voted to deny sending $1.5 billion of arms sales to Saudi Arabia because of the carnage they're causing in Yemen. The president's going to veto that. What kind of president is that? What kind of president is going to veto? Well, a president who's affected by blood-drenched arms traders, that's who. And there's no underestimating the power. Now, I'll just say one more thing. We, our government, or our arms traders, have offered military sales to Saudi Arabia worth, how much money would you say? Pardon? Hundreds of
billions.
Billions. Wow, somebody knows, right? Actually, it's 114 billion. That's a B, folks. And that's a figure that goes back just to the first day of the Obama administration. $114 billion. Now, what could we do with that money here in upstate New York or downstate New York, okay? Now, what am I saying? I'm saying that that colors our treatment of Saudi Arabia. And we give them a pass on what they do. It doesn't matter if they're bombing the Yemenis to hell, as long as they'll keep purchasing the Hellfire missiles from us to bomb them with. It's an incredibly terrible situation in terms of what runs the arms merchants that run so much of our policy.
You've been listening to a talk by Donna Marsh O'Connor and Ray McGovern entitled 9/11, 15 Years Later, What Have We Learned? They spoke at Binghamton University on September 9th, 2016. This is episode 1 of the Other Voices, Other Choices series. You can find a video of this entire talk at othervoicesotherchoices.com and at the YouTube channel of the same name. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. Thanks for listening.